friendship in adulthood is not like friendship in childhood. You cannot rely on the same set of assumptions. Friendship in adulthood does not happen organically. I'm going to repeat that. It does not happen organically. You have to try, right? And I think people are so afraid of rejection. But the reality is people are less likely to reject you than you think. Like, we have this whole culture of lonely people looking for connection, you know? And I think sometimes we assume everybody has their friends when, you know, the data is telling us, no, they do not.
So friendship, it is one of those things where we all know deep down how important it is. And there's even a ton of research showing it's about the most important thing when it comes to living a good life. And yet once we're adults, all too often, those chosen family level friends, they tend to drift away and we get so wrapped up in life. We kind of forget or become nervous about trying to make new, like, summer camp level friends. So we pretend, oh, it really just doesn't matter as much as it does, except it does. And we end up swirling in loneliness and disconnection, adrift and longing for deeper bonds. We crave spaces where we can drop our armor and be seen and known and supported. Well, if you want to transform how you show up for others and invite more reciprocity and care and belonging and love into your life, this is the conversation for you. My extraordinary guests are three relationship innovators offering vital new perspectives on community and togetherness and friendship. First, writer and activist Mia Birdsong, whose luminous book, How We Show Up, Reclaiming Family, Friendship, and Community, inspires us to question assumptions and reimagine diverse, expansive relationships beyond the isolated nuclear family model. And next up, we've got psychologist Dr. Marissa Franco, whose research-backed Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends, shares these revelatory insights on moving past barriers to forge vulnerable, fulfilling adult friendships. And finally, you'll hear from therapist Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, who's empowering Sisterhood Heals, the transformative power of friendship, just beautifully illuminates the soul-nourishing magic that unfolds when circles of Black women gather to uplift each other and what we can all learn from the notion of circles. Through vivid stories, expansive wisdom, and practical guidance, these three changemakers leave us feeling deeply hopeful about the power of showing up with heart for ourselves and others. So join us for an uplifting exploration of how to nurture bonds of platonic love that help us thrive. So excited to share this conversation with you. And one last thing, before we dive into today's conversation, I want to share a fun new project that I have created for you. It's a way to feel more alive and less alone. So after taking a years-long hiatus from public writing, I'm back and with a new weekly newsletter and community called Awake at the Wheel. So every Sunday morning in your inbox, you'll get a new story and insight written by me, along with a journaling and conversation prompt designed to help you feel more alive and less alone. And hey, even if you're not a journaler, it'll give you something to think about so that you can step into your week in a more intentional way. And just on a personal level, I am just so excited to get back to writing in a more personal, vulnerable, long-form way. It would mean the world to me if you would support this new project. So go check out the latest stories and insights and see what this week's writing and conversation prompt is now. I think you'll really like it. I'll see you over at Awake at the Wheel. Just click the link in the show notes now. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Hi, this is Matt.
And Sean.
From Two Black Guys.
With good credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert. This season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting. Good Life Project is sponsored by LinkedIn Ads. So as a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long, and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. So isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions tailored for B2B. Imagine having direct access to a billion professionals, including 180 million senior executives and 10 million C-level leaders. With LinkedIn's powerful targeting tools built for B2B, you can drive serious results. LinkedIn ads generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social platforms in the technology space. We've actually tapped the power of LinkedIn ads a number of times ourselves, and the campaigns have been really successful. If you're ready to revolutionize your B2B marketing, try LinkedIn ads with a $100 credit on your next campaign. Terms and conditions apply. Go to linkedin.com/goodlifeproject to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/goodlifeproject, or just click the link in the show notes. Terms and conditions apply. Hey, so our first guest is writer and activist Mia Birdsong. In her conversation with me, Mia challenges us to move beyond the idea that family has to mean just the traditional family structure. And she really illuminates how for most of human history, we lived interdependently in extended families and tribes. I found her perspective on why the modern nuclear family structure leaves so many wanting just really deeply thought-provoking and also inspiring. Mia provides this expansive reimagining of how we can build diverse relationships and community in ways that nurture all of our needs. Through vivid stories and insights, she really reveals practical ways that we can show up for each other and foster true intimacy, care, and belonging in our lives. I came away inspired to be more intentional about strengthening the connections that matter most. Her message just resonated deeply, and I know it will for you too. Here's Mia.
Human beings, we are wired for connection. We cannot survive without each other. We are deeply interdependent, and we are meant to be in community with each other. Even the most like hermetic person needs other people for something.
Yeah, and I completely agree. This idea of new community, and also really reimagining when we talk about not just community, but family. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we mean by that? What do we mean by friends? What do we mean by family? What do we mean by extended family? And like you were saying, like, what are the models that we can look to right now to learn from, which I'd love to explore a little bit.
Yeah.
This has been, really been the focus of the last chunk of years for you. I'm curious also, you know, because I think what really step one is this question, you know, like reimagining, well, what is it that actually makes for a good family or a good mm-hmm. community?
You know, I ask people this all the time. I'm like, what makes a good family? The first thing everyone says is love. And then they talk about, you know, people who will be there for you. They talk about people who care about you, people who will support you. And like, you know, if you're trying to do something new, like they'll support you in that. No one ever talks about structure. No one ever is like, what makes a really good family is that you have a man and a woman who are married and they have biological children. No one has ever said that to me. I think all of us fundamentally know that it is the function of family that is important, not the structure. And the fact is that the kind of insular nuclear family is a very recent invention. The idea that two people will provide like all of the things that we need from human beings, that we would get it from like one other adult, and that two people can raise children is just like on its face absurd. Like that's never in human history ever been the case. We've always had extended families. We've always had chosen family, but always had family with people who are like in our tribe who we weren't necessarily biologically related to. We have always, and when I, you know, I'm talking about like thousands of years of human history, we've always collectively raised children. So the nuclear family really is this like bizarre, unnatural anomaly. And it is not serving us because, you know, unless you are the very small percentage of people who has one person in your life who can be, you know, the person who you are romantically and sexually attracted to, and then like actually have good sex with, the person who you can be roommates with and manage a household with and commingle your finances and travel with and be your best friend and your confidant. And then if you have kids, raise kids with, like that is too many roles for two people to fill, to both fill for each other. So, you know, what I see is that a lot of folks who are trying to do that are deeply unhappy because they're not actually getting their needs met. And they don't recognize, and this is particularly true of straight men, and they don't really recognize that there are other ways for them to get some of those needs met. You know, like I'm a terrible roommate. Like my, you know, my husband and I have lived together for like 20 years, but in some other configuration of our marriage and in a world where housing was not so incredibly expensive, like it might be better for us to like, you know, live in a duplex and I could make my mess upstairs and he could keep his, you know, part neat downstairs. So part of it is about reimagining, but part of it is also recognizing that we actually used to do something else. So I think of it as both kind of understanding and looking to like our ancestral history and seeing how, you know, our people did things before, and then reimagining those structures and ways of being in relationship with each other for a modern life, right? So for what actually fits our lives.
Yeah. So it's really more of a questioning of why we're doing it the way we're doing it when we have so much history of doing it differently and very arguably experiencing our lives in so many different ways and levels better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because also there's this expectation that's set, I think, now that, you know, if you should, you know, quote, should be able to get everything you need from this nuclear family and you don't, you know, you're feeling lonely, you're feeling stressed, you're feeling overwhelmed, all the different things that, you know, like pretty much everyone tends to feel at some part of their journey in this sort of like small, tight family. If you don't feel those, then you judge yourself a failure.
Exactly.
And then you layer on top of that this sense of shame, which just makes things worse.
And then I think people end up being silent about it, right? They don't talk about it. They don't have the conversations they need to with their partner about like what they can actually do for each other. And never mind, like if you don't have a partner, right, then what are you supposed to do? There are all of these ways in which our culture, the design of like, you know, houses and cars and certainly all of the like benefits that exist in our culture are really created for and orient us toward the insular nuclear family. And there are a hell of single people in America who are having to just like navigate systems that weren't made for us and who are having to kind of exist in a culture that says that they're a failure, right? That says that there's something wrong with them. And not only is it saying that, but lots of folks also internalize that and assume that there's something wrong with them or feel as if their life is incomplete because they don't have a partner or they, you know, used to and now they don't. One of the stories in my book that I love is my friend Deanna, who does not have a romantic sexual partner, but like her and her friend Cynthia are each other's plus one. They talk about retirement. They text each other every day. They have made this friendship that they have fill the role that many people look to a romantic and sexual partner for. And they both, you know, date people and have, you know, have had other relationships, romantic and sexual relationships. But this friendship between them is primary. And I just love the model of that. And largely, like so many of the stories that I tell in the book, and the book is, you know, mostly stories. It's mostly the stories that I found that helped me understand and answer the questions that I had about creating family and community. They're just these models that they're not like blueprints for us, right? They're not like, oh, like this is what this person did. I'm going to go and replicate it. But it really is about having enough examples that allow us to expand our understanding of what's possible. And then we can kind of get into our own, you know, personal inquiry about what is it that I actually want in my life, right? One of the things that I learned from a bunch of the folks who I talked to about friendship was about kind of like getting rid of the very narrow confines of how we think about what a friendship is and what it's for. And I think about the people who I consider close friends and like be in conversation with them about like, what is the culture of our friendship? Like, what are the expectations we have of each other? What can we count on each other for? What are the boundaries that we have? And that's expanded the relationships I have with those people into places that do not fit into, you know, kind of the American box of what we say a friend is. And I love the depth of those relationships. I love the kind of intimacy that that's created between me and folks, both because we're like, we're actually having conversations about our relationship, but also because we realize like, oh, here's a thing that we want from this relationship that is not, that we wouldn't have discovered if we hadn't had this conversation about like, how do we be friends? How do we be friends?
Yeah, I mean, you're really blurring the line, you know, so mm-hmm. instead of, you know, okay, so here's the box for family, here's the box for friends, here's the box for acquaintances. It's just saying, okay, so let's throw it up against the wall and let's fundamentally ask the question, what do I want and need from the relationships in my life? What am I open to giving? And then how do I just construct it in a way from like the universe of people who are in my orbit?
Exactly.
That feels good. That gives exactly. me and that gives them what they need. And whether we call that family, whether we call it friends, who really cares at that point? Mm-hmm. But that requires, I mean, it really requires, especially in a world today where you've got real separations, right? You've got a lot of people who go the traditional family route because maybe they feel it's right for them. And very often part of that involves pulling away from all of those people who not long before really did serve a lot of those same roles. And now they become more isolated. They start to expect they get everything from the traditional family. And then the friends that they're moving away from feel like, okay, so now I'm no longer I'm no longer part of that family, but I'm also no longer a part of the bigger community of people who decided that this is the model of what family looks like for them anymore. And now you feel like, and society, as you mentioned, you know, like kind of labels them to a certain extent and says, well, you're not doing it right because you're not there yet. And it just creates more divide. So, I mean, talk about really needing to have intentional, open, and making this a very intentional act and process. I mean, it's so important.
Yeah.
You can't just wait for it to happen and hope it does.
No, I mean, you're essentially choosing to counter our culture, and doing that requires vigilance and tending. You know, so I am a cis woman and I'm married to a cis man. Like I am in a nuclear family, right? And I think the challenge that I realized in doing this work is that I needed to be vigilant, right? My husband and I need to be vigilant about making sure that we're not closing ourselves off. So I've really had to create a regular practice of making sure that I'm, you know, having conversations with my loved ones about our relationships. I'm checking in with people. I'm receiving when people check in with me. You know, one of the most powerful threads throughout the whole book is about how allergic we are to asking for help and accepting help. And how powerful it is when we get over that. Offering support to folks, I found is so much more powerful for them when it's specific. So instead of just people, you know, saying like, let me know if you need anything, I have been trying to insert myself into people's lives, right? Crossing this like boundary that we think of in our friendships, and trusting the intuition I have about what I know about people's experience and who they are, and offering something that I actually think would be helpful. So saying specifically, you know, I know you've been doing a lot of caretaking recently. Can I make like extra of what I'm making for dinner and bring it to you? As opposed to saying, let me know if you need anything. And then I think the same has been true for me. Like I've had, you know, I have a friend who in the beginning of COVID, she would text me and a couple of other people and say, hey, I'm going to the grocery store. Do you need anything? And I felt my kind of resistance to saying yes when I knew that like I'm out of salt, right? And if like I cannot cook without salt. So if I can get this one thing, that means I can like wait to go to the grocery store for another week. Like that's actually helpful for me. So I have said yes every time she has texted because there's always, you know, one or two things that I could use that would just bring ease to my life. And this last time I actually texted her and I was like, hey, next time you go, will you get us coffee? Because I knew we were going to be out of coffee in a minute. And I would totally go to the store just to get coffee, but who wants to do that? So there's a way in which kind of creating that cycle of support, both giving and receiving support, lets us know each other more deeply and creates intimacy. And I feel so much more held and so much less isolated because of the past couple of months, the way in which I feel like me and the people I'm in community with have accepted support from each other and have offered support to each other. And like, that's one of the things that I'm excited to take outside of, you know, COVID is just like allowing people, like being vulnerable enough, right, to allow people to know me in that way and to be in my life in that way and to encourage other people in my life to do the same.
Yeah. I mean, being vulnerable and allowing yourself to be seen in a vulnerable state, even if it's a mild thing, like I need this, deepens relationships. Yeah. No, I love that. And one of the things that also comes up in the context of that, I think, is something that you speak to, which is this idea of yes. And there are moments also when you want to have boundaries. But at the same time, you can negotiate ways to interact with people. One of the stories that you tell, and I thought it was a really fascinating way to approach is, you know, you talk a lot about also family around food and kitchens and friendships and how that enables all sorts of different things. And how on the one hand, it's really nice to sometimes just have people drop by. But then there are other times where you would feel, you know, like really intruded on if somebody just swung by. And we certainly live in a culture now where nobody I know in New York City does that. You know,
yeah.
If somebody just knocked on my door, even if it was a friend of mine and said, okay, hey, let's hang out.
It'd be awkward.
Yeah, it'd be awkward. I'd be kind of annoyed. And I'm like, but it's not that I don't want to see them. It's sort of like there's a context. And the way that you handled saying, okay, how do I make this happen in a way where we all feel good and comfortable, I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah. So a friend of mine talked about the fact that she would love for people to drop by. And I was like, both like, yes, that would be great. And also like, oh, hell no. Like, I don't want people just showing up on my doorstep. Like if I don't want to see them, that would just feel, I would be annoyed, like you said. So I was like, I just need to create a container for like a window in which like people are free to drop by. So I created this thing called Drop By Dinner and I emailed like 20 people and it had a set of guidelines. And the first was, you know, I don't know if I'm going to remember all of them, but like, basically like I'm not cleaning my house. I'm not preparing you a meal. You come over, bring something to add to, you know, the nourishment that we're going to have. I will give you whatever it is that I'm going to give my own children, but I'm not hosting. Right. So that was part of the thing. I was like, you don't have to RSVP. You can just show up. You can tell me you're going to show up and show up. You can tell me you're going to show up and then not show up and not explain it to me. It's really like, we're not trying to kind of replicate any kind of like party situation. I also made it clear that they could not bring anybody with them unless it was their kids. Cause I didn't want childcare to prevent people from showing up, but I also did not want to extend this experience to people like that I didn't actually feel comfortable coming by my house when it's a mess. And then I was also like, don't leave my house messier than you found it. So I was like, clean the dishes, even if I tell you not to. So I sent it out to a handful of people and I think 15 people showed up at the first one and it was spectacular. I was wearing my pajamas. I don't think I had taken a shower that day. Everybody, you know, brought food. Some people had been to my house multiple times, so they knew where everything was. And some people had never been there before and just got support from other people in figuring out how to feed themselves and get what they needed. And I would just do it every few months. And I would, you know, give people maybe a day's notice or a week's notice. And sometimes three people would show up, sometimes 15 people would show up. And having my community like collide in that way, right? Like the various parts of my community collide was fantastic. The conversations that we had were always really beautiful. And I loved the experience of having my loved ones in my home.
Yeah, I love that. I think I have a feeling that as we emerge from this space, that people are going to start to become more open to things like this. And I think I love the fact that you're sort of out there right now planting the seed to reimagine models and ways to gather and ways to define friendship and family so that we can start to really think about this more intentionally. How do we want to step back into our relationships in our world and reimagine it and recreate it? Which feels like a good place for us to come full circle as well. So hanging out here in this container of the Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
So many things. I think there's both kind of like my own personal growth and development that feels important to me, and that doesn't happen outside the context of my loved ones and the examples they give me and the ways they support me, and that doesn't happen outside the context of the people that I feel in solidarity with, even if I don't know them. And that happens in the context of not just, you know, my kind of human relations, but all of our relations. One of the things that I've leaned more heavily on in this time of physical isolation is nature, right? Like, or the other parts of nature, because human beings are nature. I'm like, I can hug a tree. A tree is not going to give me a virus, right? And I'm not going to make it sick. So there is this web that I feel like connects me with the people closest to me, my other relations that are close to me, and then ultimately all of us. And that to me, kind of being in right relationship with all of those things feels like what it means to live a good life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by LinkedIn Ads. So as a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. So isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions tailored for B2B. Imagine having direct access to a billion professionals, including 180 million senior executives and 10 million C-level leaders. With LinkedIn's powerful targeting tools built for B2B, you can drive serious results. LinkedIn ads generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social platforms in the technology space. We've actually tapped the power of LinkedIn ads a number of times ourselves, and the campaigns have been really successful. If you're ready to revolutionize your B2B marketing, try LinkedIn ads with a $100 credit on your next campaign. Terms and conditions apply. Go to linkedin.com/goodlifeproject to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/goodlifeproject, or just click the link in the show notes. Terms and conditions apply. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight-up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Thanks so much to Mia. I love how she's igniting a reimagining of what family and community can be and giving us so much to reflect on about how we show up for each other. Next up is Dr. Marissa Franco. She provides research-backed insights on transforming your relationships with empathy and with wisdom. She reveals how to overcome barriers to connection and just forge deeper bonds, which we all want and need now. Marissa's own journey from grief over lost friendships to finding belonging powerfully illustrates her advice. I found myself nodding along as she explained just really practical ways to initiate friendships, to resolve conflict, and show up authentically for others. She leaves us more hopeful about the power of platonic love to heal isolation. Here's Marissa. Your deep dive into like not just the area of loneliness, but adult relationships and friendships and platonic relationships beyond romantic. You know, this has become a sustained professional devotion for you, and you've gone deep into the work, but it's also personal. And a lot of it started in a very personal way.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was, you know, especially as a woman, just receiving all these messages around romantic love is what makes you worthy. If you don't have a romantic partner, you don't have love, you're not worthy, something's wrong with you, right? And that made me really take, when I went through these breakups when I was younger, it made me really take them hard and feel like so bad. And it definitely magnified my grief. And I decided to start this wellness group with my friends to feel better, where we met up and every week we practiced wellness. It was meditating, it was cooking, it was doing yoga, it was eating cupcakes, it was cooking dinner for one another. And it was such a potent force in my life. Like literally, it was so visceral. Every week I had these people that loved me who I love. And it just got to the point where I was like, I can't deny that this is meaningful. I can't deny that this is beautiful. I can't deny the gravity of this form of love in my life when I have it being shown to me every week with these people I feel so safe with. And it was for me looking around and thinking, I've been taught that this love doesn't matter. I've been taught that it is ancillary, superfluous, unnecessary. I've been taught that I should center my life around a different form of love. And I've felt like I had no love in my life, right? And how does that make any sense when I have like all of these people that have loved me for such a long time? And so I just felt like, oh my gosh, these messages that I've received are so damaging. And I really feel like it's just so important for me to unlearn them. And not just that, I think that my experience, like the personal is political, you know, I think Audre Lorde says that my experience reflects a larger societal, political kind of reality, right? That all of us have this like internalized hierarchy, I'll say, of relationships, with these romantic relationships at the top. And I really began to question that hierarchy and to want to see, to want to give myself permission to see friendship for a sacred relationship that it could be. And to almost stop compartmentalizing love in a way, right? It's like it was almost like a fetishization of love, that romantic love is like this ideal, like this lofty ideal, right? Nothing comes close to it. And now obviously having been through a lot more relationships, seeing that every relationship is good and also has its difficulties, and romantic love is beautiful, but platonic love is also beautiful. And there's really no reason to put our relationships on such a hierarchy. And I think it makes so many of us so isolated, whether we're single or we are in a relationship, because if you have this hierarchy and you're in a relationship, then you try to get all your needs met through one person. And tons of research finds that like that is a recipe for disaster. It harms your mental health. It harms the mental health of your spouse. So I really wrote Platonic wanting to be like, hey, can we take a look at this like cultural script? Like, can we take a look at some of the ways that it's actively harming us? Like, can we take a look at how we're so lonely and this may be a part of it? Like, to me, it's like, we've always had this gold under our feet in friendship, but we've just been taught to see it as concrete. We don't see it glimmer and we don't see it glitter, even though it's right in front of us. So I just kind of wanted us to all see that, like, platonic love can be so, so profound.
I love that. And, you know, the notion that romantic love, you know, like finding that one person and then demanding from them everything you need in every relationship at all times. It's like when you sort of lay it out that way, you're like, oh, that is utterly absurd. And yet that's the ideal we hold ourselves to. Like that, like every rom-com movie, every like book, this, it's all like, this is what we aspire to in life. And like, once you hit that magic place, you know, you don't really need anybody else. And the reality is just like the complete opposite. And like you said, often that assumption causes so much harm to us individually and to the relationship and to like those we might be in partnership with. It's also just not true. You know, it's those other relationships. And so often I feel like, and I'm curious whether you see this in your work, when people, even if you're somebody who finds that one person, you end up jettisoning so many of the other like truly loving, sometimes long-term sustained relationships from your life. And it actually does harm to those relationships, not intentionally, not because you want to do it. It's sort of like part of the set of assumptions that you say yes to when like you're trying to build with this one other person. And yet it's like we just allow these other things to fall away because all of a sudden they're not supposed to matter as much.
And you know what? I just think biologically, we have always needed an entire community to feel whole. And that's no less true now. There's actually, you know, we talked about loneliness. There's actually three types of loneliness, only one of which can be fulfilled by a spouse, which is intimate loneliness, the desire for a very close, intimate relationship. There's relational loneliness, which is desire for a relationship that's as close as a friend. And then collective loneliness, which is a desire for a group that's working towards a common goal, right? And there's just all these other studies, for example, that find that when I become friends with someone, no, I'm less depressed, but also my spouse becomes less depressed. That when I have conflict within my marriage, my potential marriage, I'm not married, but I experience stress hormone release in dysregulated ways or wacky ways. You know, my stress hormone release just like gets off kilter, but not if I have quality connection outside of that marriage. Other studies find that for women who are particularly tend to be more experience more intimate friendships, when they go through difficult experiences in their marriage, they tend to be more resilient to those experiences. And then these people that focus on one person, what we see for them in the research is that their mental health really ebbs and flows with the health of their relationship. Like if their relationship's not okay, their mental health is not okay. Whereas these people that have those connections outside, they can stay centered even when their relationship is going through the natural ebbs and flows. And that is such a resource, right? For me to get into conflict with my spouse and return to them in a way where I'm centered. I'm no longer in fight or flight mode because I've relied on other people to bring me back to that centered place. And then I'm able to address this conflict with you in a way in which I'm listening to you. I have the capacity to hear you. I have the capacity to try to communicate in a way that's not attacking or threatening you. Like, I just think sometimes I think we see these two relationships as antagonistic. Like you're spending time with your friends, you're not spending time with me, but really they're synergistic. Like you're spending time with your friends. We're going to have more quality time together then. So thank you.
Yeah. And that makes so much sense. And yet I feel like sometimes you'll hear about people who look at those friendships that exist outside of a central, intimate or romantic relationship as a quote threat to the relationship. Whereas in fact, what you're laying out is like, no, like there's science on this, you know, and the science says, no, if anything, you know, they're going to help support that relationship. They're going to make it easier for you to come back to each other, you know, like when, or move through challenging moments in a more grounded and open space. I'm fascinated by just how we like layer these assumptions and expectations into relationships in a way that culturally we're told is the way to do it. And yet, you know, like the data is clear as day and it's like, no, it's actually kind of the exact opposite. So I love the invitation that you've been offering to really kind of like just reimagine, you know, how we build relationships. But also I think it's important to note that doing this as a grown-up is not the easiest thing.
It is harder. Like it is. And there's this sociologist, Rebecca G. Adams, and she says, like, For friendship to happen organically, we need repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. And that's what we have as kids, like gym, recess, lunch. I see you every day. We have these settings where we can let our guard down, right? As adults, we don't have that. Like, you can think of, okay, the one place I see people every day is work, but am I actually vulnerable in work? Like, do I actually like share a deep, maybe you do, Jonathan, but for most people, right, they tend to go to work and show like a certain side of them, a certain dimension of them, a certain persona, you know, a lot of the time, which is why one study found that the more time we spend together at work, the less close that we feel. So what that means is that friendship in adulthood is not like friendship in childhood. You cannot rely on the same set of assumptions. Friendship in adulthood does not happen organically. I'm going to repeat that. It does not happen organically. You have to try. You know, there was this one study that looked at people that saw friendship as happening based on luck were lonelier 5 years later. Mm. Whereas those that saw it as happening based on effort were less lonely 5 years later because they made that effort, right? And I think people are so afraid of rejection, right? But the reality is people are less likely to reject you than you think. Like, we have this whole culture of lonely people looking for connection, you know? And I think sometimes we assume everybody has their friends when, you know, the data is telling us, no, they do not. And, you know, this is based on research on something called the liking gap, where when strangers interact, they underestimate how liked they are by the other person, right? So that brings me to one of my favorite tips that tends to really resonate with people. You know, you have to initiate, you know, you have to contact someone and say, hey, it's so great to connect with you. Like, I'd love to connect further, right? You know, you have to do that. But the psychological thing that has to happen is you have to start assuming people like you, like start that practice of reminding yourself, people like me, right? And what this will do for you, according to this research on something called the acceptance prophecy, that when people are told that based on your personality profile, we predict that you'll go into this group and be liked, they actually become warmer and friendlier and more open.
Hmm.
Whereas you will notice that when you think people are rejecting you, how does that impact your behaviors? Like, according to the science, people that see rejection all the time, they tend to be colder. They tend to be more withdrawn. If you think you're going to be rejected, you reject people first. Like, that's what you do, right? And so fundamentally how you show up is like, people might be rejecting you when you think you're being rejected because you actually are rejecting them in terms of how that's affecting your behavior. So assume people like you, and then you're going to have to initiate.
You talk about this distinction also between what you phrase as covert and overt avoidance. Tease this out for me.
Yeah. So I think when we're like, I want to make friends, people are like, okay, sign up for that group, you know, join that meetup group, right? And, you know, I think back to myself in college, I want to make friends. I think I joined like some sort of like cultural group, and I went to one meeting and nobody talked to me. Nobody said hi to me. And I was like, they're very clicky here. I'm not going to return. And how wrong I was. This is what I would tell my younger self, right? To make friends, you have to overcome overt avoidance, which means you show up, right? Overt avoidance is I'm scared, so I'm staying home. But you also have to overcome covert avoidance, which means when you are engaged in covert avoidance, you show up physically, but you check out mentally. I'm on my phone. I'm walking away from the group. I'm talking to the one person I already know, right? Like, you're not introducing yourself. Whereas overcoming that looks like, I'm at that group in college and I'm saying, oh, hey, like, I'm Marissa. It's so good to meet you. How have you liked being a part of this group? Tell me more about it. Like, I'd love to hear, right? It's not just showing up that's going to make you friends. It's that you actually have to engage with people when you get there. Because, like, to be honest, like, making friends is really, I used to think these are all my college misconceptions that, oh, if I want to make friends in college, I have to be funny. I have to be charismatic. I have to be, you know, smart. I have to say something that's going to make people flock to me, right? But what I know now, based on the research and lived experience, is that according to this theory called the theory of inferred attraction, people like people that they think like them. Hmm. And the number one thing people look for in a friend is someone that makes them feel loved and valued. So being good at making a friend is not about changing your personality. It's changing how you treat people. It's treating them in a kind and loving way, right? And fundamentally, anything that you do to convey to someone that you like them, whether that's kindness or being generous towards them or praising them, right, is going to make it more likely that you're going to form friendship with them. So even when you overcome that covert avoidance and you say, hey, my name's Marissa, like, how have you enjoyed this group so far? It's so good to meet you. You know, what that's doing is it's conveying to someone, I am interested in you as a person, right? And that's the sort of underlying mechanism that explains why it makes us friends.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me. One of the other things that you really talk about in the context of adult friendships, which is the notion of conflict, you know, which is the notion of people are going to make mistakes. People are going to mess up. People are just going to get angry either like for good reason or for no good reason at all. Conflict is going to arise. And you know, the way that we handle that in the context of either an emerging or established friendship, I think is so critical in whether that deepens the friendship or just completely blows it up.
Absolutely. Conflict is where my anxious attachment comes up the most. Like you said, like your body kind of taking over and feeling like it's on fire. Like that's what happens for me over conflict. And I tell the story in the book about how literally my best friend had done a series of small things that I had not addressed. And I literally could see myself starting to withdraw from her. And I felt kind of stuck because I started to recognize it's not helping this relationship for me to avoid this conflict because now I'm withdrawing. But also, if I address this conflict, my anxiously attached side is telling me it's going to get grisly. We're going to be attacking each other, right? It's going to be antagonistic, right? And I read this study that really changed things for me. It's in people that are more secure around conflict. This might not be a revelation, but it was for me. And it found that having open, empathic conflict is actually linked to deeper intimacy. And that people that are good at conflict actually are less lonely. So I'm like, oh, these people that are, and people that really value friendship are more likely to have conflict with their friends, bring up conflict with their friends. So I'm like, oh, okay. So conflict is part of healthy relationships, part of a healthy behavior. Like ignoring things is actually a dysfunctional way to show up in your friendships again, because you're just going to withdraw. It's not going to go away. So not only did I read that study, like research is like my spiritual advisor, I'll say. I'm like, I'm so confused. I'm not going to call a mentor. I'm just going to start Googling psych info, all the research studies. So the research kind of showed me that I could learn these skills of bringing up conflict in a way that would make it more likely that this is going to go well. So it's first starts with framing the argument, which involves framing the conflict as a sign of love and intimacy and reconciliation. So me saying, hey, I bring this up because like, I really want us to stay close and I don't want anything to get between us. So I just want to make sure I'm bringing things up as they come up. So that doesn't happen because I love you so much, right? Sharing the I statements, like I felt X, I felt hurt when you didn't respond to me at that really important moment. Perspective taking, but I was wondering, you know, what might be going on your end in that moment, right? This was a big one. Jeff Simpson, he's a researcher. He told me about, because he said, secure people make other people look good in conflict because they de-escalate, right? Mm. So there was a time when my best friend, I brought up this conflict. I told her, you know, she said this thing that kind of hurt me. And she was like, I'm going to feel like I'm walking on eggshells around you. Like, I feel like I do everything wrong. And of course, I could have escalated at that point. You know, I was a little triggered. But instead, I said, you do so many things right. And I'm so sorry that I haven't conveyed to you all the things that you do right, all the ways that you show up so well in this friendship. Like, literally, there is this thing that I want to talk about and work through. But like, there's nothing, there hasn't been anything else. Like, all the other times we interact, like, I've just felt so good and so comfortable and so loved by you. And so being able to like de-escalate, like hear them out, validate their feelings, show them love when they're like kind of being reactive towards you, like it's like a next level conflict skill. And then ask for what your needs are. Like, okay, next time this happens, could we do X, Y, Z? Like, how would that be for you? And then I'm like, oh, this is what conflict can be. It's like reconciliation. It's like collaboration. It's not like a mutual attack on one another. And the other thing that I realized, because Jonathan, one of my gripes about her, she did not do. Like, it was like, I think I sent her my book proposal and I never heard back from her about it. And she did respond to me. I didn't see the email. So I realized by not bringing up conflict, I am holding you guilty without giving you a trial, right? It's like, that's really unfair for me to not bring up this problem when you might have had some extenuating circumstances, or fundamentally, I might have been perceiving things wrong, right? And that will change how this sits with me. So it's almost like, let's just reconcile. Let's come to a mutual sense of reality right now that's going to help us emotionally be able to move forward in this friendship.
I think so much of the conversation is really sort of like, if you zoom the lens out, it's about really, really being willing to just step back into conversation, relationship with other people, be real, be open, be vulnerable, and do it in a way, you know, that doesn't make you melt down in the process and go running for the hills. Because as you shared in the beginning of this conversation, these relationships matter. You know, it's like there's, even if you do have that one person who's a deep and like they're your quote person, you know, like quoting Meredith Grey, right? That's Sandra Oh. You know, we all still need others, you know, and those other platonic, intimate, like deeply loving friendships. Feels like a good place to come full circle as well. So in this Container of Good Life project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
You must see others and be seen.
Thank you. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So I love how Marissa is bringing more light to the profound power of platonic love and giving us so much inspiration and practical guidance on overcoming loneliness through friendship. And our final guest in this spotlight conversation on friendship is Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, host of the wildly popular podcast Therapy for Black Girls. Through her work with Therapy for Black Girls and her vital new book, Sisterhood Heals, Joy really illuminates the soul-nourishing magic that happens when Black women gather in circles. With wisdom and care, she reveals how group dynamics can strengthen bonds if you understand them. And she shares really touching stories of women finding refuge and wisdom and growth together. Above all, she leaves us more hopeful about the power of prioritizing platonic love and sisterhood and friendship and circles and supporting each other through life's journey. Join us for an inspiring and powerful exploration of the transformative force of sisterhood. Here's Dr. Joy.
When I talk about sisterhood, I'm specifically talking about the relationships between Black women and not in a familiar way, right? Like your sister is your biological sister, or your adopted sister, but the sisterhood that exists kind of simply because we are all Black women in these relationships that, you know, can be very close, but also just, you know, I see you in the grocery store, I see you in school, and there is like a shared understanding, there's a shared history. And my experience has been that that has been very healing for Black women. And we typically find ourselves in circles. So whether it is as a part of a knitting group or a church group, or if it is your more intimate friend group, it typically happens within a circle. And those dynamics that I just talked about that are happening in group therapy also happening in our circles. And so it felt important to talk about the things that I've learned as a therapist and somebody who has practiced group therapy, and to help people understand like, hey, these are some of the same dynamics happening in your life. And here's how we can use this to make the relationship stronger.
Mm. And it's interesting, obviously, middle-aged white male, I step into it. And what you're describing, I can't experience, I'll never experience in the same way, clearly.
Right.
And yet the notion of sisterhood, the notion of circles, is sort of like the fundamental construct of coming together, is deeply resonant for me and is deeply resonant for a lot of people. You walk through some really interesting ideas, sort of like guideposts and keys. Like if we're going to come together and do it in a healthy way, in a functional way, in a supportive way, what really matters? You know, like what are the important things to think about and what are the dynamics to expect to unfold? So I'd love to walk through some of those. You introduced this notion of sisterhood and the four S's. So tell me about the four S's.
Yeah. So the four S's of sisterhood are the kind of, I think, when I think about like the guiding themes of like what makes sisterhood so powerful and what makes it so magical, I think in a lot of ways, I think about it in terms of these four S's. So four S's are that sisterhood allows us to be seen. So, you know, like we're not invisible to one another, which I think is really, really important. It allows us to soften. So there are so many places in our lives where we have to kind of put on this like really heavy armor to show up. And in sisterhood and in relationship with one another, we don't have to do that. So it allows us to soften. It allows us to know more about ourselves and allows other people to kind of know us better. So it allows us to have a greater sense of knowing who we are. There's a lot about us. I think just generally we don't know until it shows up in relationship to one another. And so I think in engaging in deep sisterhood in relationship with one another, we have a greater knowing of ourselves. And then the fourth S is that it allows us to support other people and it allows us to be supported.
The way you're describing those four S's, it feels like they're each speaking to a specific pain. If you talk about like one of the S's is being seen, well, then the pain would be not being seen or being invisible.
Right.
You know, to soften, I guess the assumption under that would be that like, you feel like that outside of that circle, the safety of that circle, that sisterhood, that you've got to take on the persona of being hard, of being tough, a variety of reasons that like are very valid reasons. But there's a pain, there's a cost to that. And that like there needs to be a place where you've got to be able to drop that, to be able to just breathe and be okay.
Yeah. I mean, if we go back to, you know, our earlier conversation around like all of the mental health implications of loneliness, there are some very real mental health implications to this idea that we need to be like tough and strong and like on all the time. Like it's just not sustainable. But I think a lot of Black women find themselves in spaces where they feel like they can't drop that armor. And I'm arguing that with one another, we can create those spaces where we don't have to have that armor on all the time.
It's interesting also, you described that people tend to gravitate towards certain common roles within a group.
Mm-hmm.
And you described these four, the leader, the wallflower, firecracker, and peacemaker. Walk me through these really quickly, because clearly we have all either been or like been in a group with people who play in those roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's important to know that these are not like absolute, and you might yourself kind of between roles and different in different groups, which I think is interesting. But the wallflower is kind of the person in the group who is mostly quiet, and they may not be saying a lot, but when they do speak, like everybody pays attention because it tends to be really impactful. The leader of the group is kind of what a leader you would expect, is kind of the person who is takes the responsibility for organizing when y'all get together. They probably are the person that hosts and like, you know, all of the details and like the stuff that really makes a group move. The leader typically kind of takes that on. The firecracker is the person who kind of will say the thing that needs to be said, but not always in the tactful kind of ways. But, you know, again, those kinds of things are important for like moving a group forward. And then the peacemaker is the person where, you know, if a couple of people in the group are not talking, they are the one who's going to try to bring them together. Like, let's talk this out. They're kind of the voice of reason in a group.
What you're describing also, it's interesting because you're taking these dynamics from sort of a controlled group therapy and saying, like, let me share a whole bunch of guideposts and invitations and offerings out so that to create sisterhoods and circles that are functional and healthy. But it occurs to me, like, you've got to be relatively self-aware to keep the dynamic healthy in a group, because if you're not aware of your own inner thoughts and workings and feelings, let alone, you know, the group dynamic, it's hard to notice what is and isn't happening and what's real and what's not real and respond to it in a functional way.
And isn't that the importance of like doing our work for any relationship?
Yeah, right.
You know, I think that there is a level of like self-awareness that, of course, you know, not everybody has. But I think to make most relationships work and kind of make them function, it really does require us to kind of be present and aware of like what we're bringing to the table and like how we get activated by certain things and whether we shut down or whether we, you know, kind of go too far. Like, I think all relationships call that from us. And so, again, you know, the goal is not for people to kind of run their own mini therapy groups. It really is like, okay, how can you just be more aware of these things and pay attention to the fact that these dynamics exist and use them to your advantage to, you know, kind of help everybody out.
One of the other things I thought was really interesting that you share is important to think about a source of potential conflict. It is the notion of differences in values, which I thought was really interesting because you could come together, right, as a group and share a lot of history. But sharing history doesn't necessarily mean that you see the world the same way or that you share the same values. Talk to me more about how this shows up.
Yeah. And I think that there are some things that are like just differences in preferences, right? Like whether you like Coke and I like Pepsi, you know, like those kinds of things. But what I'm really talking about is like, are you fundamentally opposed to like who I am in the world, right? Or how I show up? And we saw this a lot during the pandemic. I think a lot of friend groups were shaken up around decisions to get the vaccine or not get the vaccine, decisions to mask or not mask. People who, you know, had a higher risk tolerance and were kind of still out doing things, and other people who had a lower risk tolerance. And I don't think people really understood like how to navigate that, because in a lot of ways, those kinds of things had not entered friendship groups before. And so I think the pandemic really gave people a chance to kind of explore values and like, what does this really mean? And so I think, you know, sometimes we get to a place where we realize like a friendship may not be able to continue because we just fundamentally see the world differently in a way that clashes like with my humanity. And I think, again, the pandemic really brought that to light for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, that really flows into a conversation that you have around life cycles with sisterhoods, with circles, with friendships, in that some are meant to last for long times and some are not. And sometimes they end. Sometimes an individual friendship ends, sometimes an entire sisterhood, as you know, like a circle dynamic ends, maybe even after years. And there's a real grief experience that happens when that comes to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of times we don't think about like the grief related to a friendship because it's not somebody dying, right? Like, I think a lot of our society really only has rituals for the death of someone, but there's grief we experience because of lots of different things. And so I talk about this sense of disenfranchised grief, which means that people don't take it as seriously when you lose a friendship because they feel like, oh, you have other friends or there are other people. And so then you're left with like this real sense of grief, just as if someone had died, but like nobody's really paying attention to it or they're not giving it the same credence. And so then you're just kind of left with all of these feelings and not sure how to make sense of it. And so I think when that happens, it is really important to find somebody who's not going to make you feel ashamed because a friendship has ended and to, you know, to be able to find a supportive community of people who will allow you to talk through, you know, whatever you're experiencing for as long as you need to.
What about the opposite problem, which is sort of like when something kind of really needs to end? But, you know, when enough of the things that brought you together in the beginning, you know, like they're just not there anymore, yet nobody wants to be the person.
Yes.
Because that comes up, you know, and that I think is really dicey also. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate those moments?
I think it is really hard for us as a society to say goodbyes. You know, so I talk about this in the book, like it is, but it is really important to say goodbye, to like offer yourself some sense of closure to relationships that have been important, even if you know that they are not going to continue. And so I think the tendency or, you know, some people's kind of inclination would be to just like stop calling or to like just kind of slowly ghost out of the picture. But in talking with lots of women, that kind of ghosting experience is actually far more painful than like somebody saying, you know, like, okay, this is kind of, we've come to the end of the road. And so I think if you find yourself in a situation where you know you're going to have to end a friendship, it is the kindest thing for both you and the person to be able to actually say to them, whatever it is going on, right? Like, I don't feel like we see the world the same, or, you know, I feel like I've been betrayed, or whatever it is that's leading you to end the friendship. It's important to be able to say that to the person so that they're not left kind of making up their own stories about what happened and like what could have been different. Because again, it just leaves you with all these questions and like wondering, yeah, like, what did you do wrong? Like, did I overstep? Like, you know, it just is a barrel of questions. And it is never easy to end a relationship. Like, nobody wants to have that awkward conversation. But again, I think you owe it to yourself and to this person who at one point did mean a lot to you to offer them some kind of resolution and like letting them know, like, this is where you're standing, you're moving on.
Yeah. And that kind of brings us, you know, let's circle all the way back around. Like, we can't talk about ending relationships, you know, without also talking about like, how do we actually start them? How do we, and I think that is something that so many struggle with now. It's like, how do you actually find those new people in the context you're talking about? Like, how do you find new Black and brown women to bring into a sisterhood or to bring into a circle? Like, more broadly, how does any grown up do that? Because as a kid, we're just in these constructs that automatically bring us together in community with people who we share history or likeness with. But as adults, it's almost like we now have to proactively go and do these things. Mm-hmm. And you speak to this in a bunch of different ways in the book, but share some thoughts here, because I think this is not just intuitive for most people.
It is not. It's not. And you're right. Like, when we're young, like, we're in class with all these kids, and so these become our friends, right? And, you know, once you're older and not in college settings or education settings, it's just much more difficult. And so one thing that I suggest is to pay attention to the people who are kind of in the background of your life, who could actually become maybe more of the foreground. So is there somebody that you kind of see in your Pilates class all the time and y'all exchange pleasantries, but it doesn't go much further? Or is there a mom that you see in the carpool line that, you know, you're kind of friendly with, but it doesn't go any further than carpool? And thinking about like, okay, is there an opportunity to make some of those relationships a little bit more formal, a little bit more intense? So can you say like, hey, do you want to grab a smoothie after Pilates? Or like, oh, we should really grab lunch before we head to the carpool line, so that you can take some steps to maybe get to know these people a little better, but not necessarily with the expectation that they're going to be like lifelong friends. You're just kind of putting yourself out there to, you know, kind of widen your circle of people who could become close to you.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, the notion of also finding places where somebody else has already done the work of gathering the people who you want to be in community with. I mean, this is exactly what you've done for years, right? With Therapy for Black Girls, with 3 for Thursdays. You've created this incredible space. Tell me more about the space and how people show up in it.
Yeah, so 3 for Thursdays is this thing I started, I think, before the pandemic, but definitely became much more intense during the pandemic. But every Thursday at 12 noon, we jump on Zoom so people can sign up for the Zoom link. It's a free session to participate in. And we talk about some particular topic. So we may talk, and I typically have 3 points to share for people. So 3 ways to be more assertive, 3 things to think about as you think about spring cleaning, like whatever the topic is. I kind of pick random topics, but people can also suggest topics. And I share the 3 points, and then we have conversation around, you know, what resonates for people, how have they seen this work in their own lives. But people also will like give us updates off previous sessions, or there will be questions unrelated to the topic that people will have. And so it really has just become a very, very cool space for women to kind of get together, to support one another, to laugh with one another, to hold each other accountable. And it's just really like, I think, a glowing example of like what sisterhood actually can look like in practice, because the women don't necessarily know one another beyond getting together every Thursday, but certainly some of them have gotten closer because, you know, they kind of continue to see each other in this space. And so I think it is just a great example of the kinds of spaces where you can find people who, you know, can become a part of your circle.
Yeah, I love that also because it's we're talking about gathering through technology. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people have the reason, even though we've all been sort of trained to be much more comfortable with it over the last 3 years, there's still a lot of resistance. I think there's still a lot of assumptions that maybe like that's not as real. Mm. And certainly it's not the same as being in person with people. But I think like what you've created, this like just stunning global community, it's proof positive that really deep, rich, powerful connections can happen in the virtual space. Don't write it off.
Exactly. Yeah. I do want people to make sure they're paying attention to being open to digital kinds of connections, because you're right. Like it may not be exactly the same, but I think that there are some very powerful connections and very great relationships that can be formed even when you connect in digital spaces, because it really is about the consistency. It's about like peeling back the layers. Like all of those things are important, and those things can happen digitally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as we start to wrap our conversation, zooming the lens out a little bit, what's your big invitation? What's your big hope for people as they start to think about all the ideas that you've been offering?
I really want people to center platonic relationships in their lives and to really dig deeper into how we can support one another better and really show up for one another, but also allow other people to show up for us. Because I think a lot of us find ourselves as like the go-getters, I mean, kind of the one who is checking on other people. But I also really think it's important for us to be able to ask for help and allow ourselves to be in spaces of vulnerability with one another.
So coming full circle, I've asked you this very same question, but it's a chunk of years ago now, and the world has changed and we've all changed. If I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To live a good life means to be intentional and purposeful about establishing meaningful connections with other people.
Thank you. So I don't know about you, but I just really feel like those were a lot of powerful, heart-opening conversations. I'm so grateful to Mia and Marissa and Joy for shining a light on the life-changing magic of showing up with presence and care, vulnerability in our relationships. Their stories and insights, they have inspired me to really nourish my own connections with greater intention. And I hope this episode left you feeling uplifted and empowered to cultivate extraordinary bonds that your soul just might be yearning for. And if you love this episode, be sure to catch the full conversations with today's guests. You can find a link to those episodes in the show notes. This episode of Good Life Project was produced by executive producers Lindsay Fox and me, Jonathan Fields. Editing help by Alejandro Ramirez. Christopher Carter crafted our theme music, and special thanks to Shelley Adele for her research on this episode. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please go ahead and follow Good Life Project in your favorite listening app. And if you found this conversation interesting or inspiring or valuable, and chances are you did since you're still listening here, would you do me a personal favor, a 7-second favor, and share it, maybe on social or by text or by email, even just with one person? Just copy the link from the app you're using and tell those you know, those you love, those you want to help navigate this thing called life a little better, so we can all do it better together with more ease and more joy. Tell them to listen. Then even invite them to talk about what you've both discovered, because when podcasts become conversations and conversations become action, that's how we all come alive together. Until next time, I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.